Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya Dharma, Namo Buddhaya Sangha. Nice to see you all here today. We are 1 month into Ango. I hope you can feel it. In the blurb, I said I was going to try to fix some misunderstandings about equanimity. Often for me, Dharma talks arise out of puzzles that I am having in Sanzen. And I've had a series of Sanzen in the last month where that basically like depended on more clarity about equanimity. Sometimes we have good self-awareness, we have a consistent daily practice, good motivation, and something is just not budging. And for that to change, we need deeper insight, which requires more stable mindfulness, a higher level of equanimity. So I want to map that territory a little bit and highlight what I see as the three most likely confusions. And I would encourage you to, as I'm describing this, like notice like how you play this out, right? Like the stories you tell yourself, the things which catch you in this territory. So big picture, equanimity is this matter of factness with our actual experience of life. An even-mindedness despite the presence of pleasure or pain. When we're accessing equanimity, we're not compelled to push or pull at our experience. We don't need it to be other than it is. We don't feel pressure. Internal pressure to extend the duration of things we like or to get away from things we don't like. Looking at this from the rubric of skandhas, I couldn't, like vedana feeling is this basic, like fleeting, momentary liking or disliking that arises with any moment of consciousness. That's not where equanimity is happening. Equanimity is happening right after that, when perception and formation, once we start to identify and relate to, once we make it about who we are, that's the territory that equanimity is useful for. So with equanimity, we have the physical sensation of pain or pleasure, but we don't identify with it or relate to it. It's not super relevant to who we are. The Sanskrit for equanimity is upekkha, occasionally pratramajjhapatta. I had to look that one up. Upekkha means to look at as a spectator. Pratramajjhapatta means to stand in the middle of. So they're kind of two different aspects of it, but giving you this sense that we're observing, we're close, but we're not affected by. It shows up a lot in Buddhism, right? It's the fourth of the Brahmaviharas. More on that later. It's the defining characteristic of the fourth jhana. It's seventh in the factors of enlightenment. It's at the end of a lot of lists. It's important. It's hard. Those are clues. If it's the last on a list, those are three lists that, personally for me, have been really impactful. And like, there's lots of other lists that equanimity shows up on, but those are all ones that I can happily riff on. I point these out just to underline that early Buddhism saw this as a really important part of practice, fruit of practice. Later Buddhism did too. Zhizhu was a Chinese term that was used to translate samtusi, which we might translate as satisfaction or gratification. Part of the shift as Buddhism transitioned from India to China, like there was a language translation, but there was also a cultural translation. And this was one place where you can notice a shift from the more Indian sensibility of choosing austerities to escape suffering to a more Chinese approach of appreciating aspects of life in difficult circumstances. Reiju's Dharma talk last week really underlined the more Chinese approach of noticing what we can appreciate in difficult circumstances. So translation is always interpretation, and this adjustment helped weave equanimity into the Chinese cultural background at that time. Nelson Foster has a nice discussion of it in his book, Storehouse of Treasures. Zen is a big fan of equanimity also. Dogen's Eight Realizations for a Great Being, of a Great Being, I guess. The first two are having few desires and knowing contentment. This is the last fascicle that Dogen wrote just a month or two before he died, which adds a little import. It's also, the fascicle is, it's a very simple one. It's almost entirely a series of quotes from the Buddha. And it's quoting the Buddha's purported last sermon. This pairing of having few desires and knowing contentment is found throughout Chinese Zhan literature. And shows up in the Platform Sutra, shows up in the Vimalakirti Sutra. So it's a kind of Zen way of pointing to equanimity. I feel like these are underappreciated, having few desires and knowing contentment. And I acknowledge we're living in a time where these are actively, energetically, and persistently assaulted by the media landscape. So, the main event is three misses. And I would say, content, like the near enemy and like the spectrum. Those are how I might title them. So the first one, the content is one thing that I see is equanimity being confused with neutrality. And neutrality is just not having an opinion on something, right? It concerns beliefs, ideas, opinions. Sometimes we aspire to be equanimous and are neutral, right? So what do you want for breakfast? Oh, I'll just have what you're having. That's neutrality. That's not necessarily equanimity. Occasionally we really are. There's just no opinion on the matter, right? That we find. But we may probably feel some pressure to withhold, repress, obfuscate, or deny opinions that are present if they don't fit our self-concept or aspiration. And especially if part of your aspiration is being a spiritual person, a good Zen student, something of that nature, that's a danger to watch out for. Because a less trained mind spends a high percentage of its time in thought on mind objects, it's natural to orient to fixing this layer, fixing with quotation marks, of beliefs, ideas, opinions. And it's an easy place to put energy, right? We're familiar with it. We know, we just have lots of lot of sense of self there, so it's easy to mobilize it in that domain. But it's not very effective. Equanimity isn't about the beliefs we hold, it's about the workings of mind. Right? So we can change the beliefs we hold or squish them around, and it's not going to give you an actual felt sense of equanimity. Is that basically making sense? Okay, great. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, a belief is a mind object. Under certain conditions, it just arises. Part of experiencing that mind object is a subjective liking or disliking, and that's the part that equanimity controls. Like that's where it's useful, is right after that subjective liking or disliking. So equanimity does affect beliefs, even if it's not about beliefs. If a mind object arises, we dislike it, and we don't react, that mind object, next time it arises, is going to have less oomph, slightly. So our conditioning changes, right? Like that's one way in which awareness affects, like, neuroplasticity. You know, our conditioning is morphing. And yeah, every intentional act is productive of future horizons of who we think we are. If we're not being mindful, like the default direction, the default change is towards less freedom, right? If we are being mindful, skillfully mindful, then it's moving towards more freedom, less hindrance, less like constrained by conditioning. So the second confusion is the near enemy of equanimity. So if we're aiming for equanimity and we end up disengaged, dissociated, indifferent, apathetic, something in that realm, it's an avoidant protective response. It's quite common culturally. In some contexts, it's pretty celebrated. I feel like people kind of know about this one. I feel like we talk about it a fair amount. And so I'm not going to go into a lot of detail, but I wanted to it shows up in the sounds in the room a lot, right? Confusion around this. So, I guess the basically what I want to say about it here is that, it's not a flattening of the amplitude of life. Like, that's not what equanimity is. That's what indifference does. Like, with equanimity, we have the full amplitude, pleasure, pain, whatever. We're just, it's just that we're, like, soft in relation to it. We're okay to experience it. We don't have to protect. Part of the protection, like, you know, there's certain things that it just feels like, if I experience that, then I will surely die, right? It's just, it's too scary. It's too threatening. You know, we all have those dark alleys in our psyche. But it doesn't have to be at that level of extremity. A lot of what we're steering around is judgment, you know, the self-judgment you know, like we police our mental chatter. And like if we're adding judgment to the noticing, it's painful, right? It hurts. And that's like negative reinforcement is easier to do and is much less effective. So I really encourage people, when you're noticing karma, when you're noticing your internal world, to like appreciate that you caught it, regardless of it meaning you're making a mistake or you did something good, but just like appreciate the awareness. Let that be a celebration. Like, I remember one of the things Kyogen liked to say was, the moment of recognizing that you're distracted is perfect meditation. And that irritated me, all right? Like, I was like, that's such a weak, I just didn't like it, right? It's super true. Give me a break. But it took me a decade to appreciate it. I wanted it to be more special than that somehow. I wanted it to be more other. But it's not, it's right here. So please enjoy the noticing. I'd also say about this that it's easier to work with attachment than apathy. I'd rather people fall on that side of the tightrope, all in all. There's more information, there's more engagement, it's more immediate suffering, so it might be more access to motivation. In the Dharma talk today, Takumi was said to be attached. Okay. The third confusion I want to bring up is not understanding just how significant equanimity can be. It's a really broad continuum. Getting some frustrating news, taking a deep breath, refraining from throwing a tantrum is entry-level equanimity. That's great. I appreciate it. And there's more. And deeper levels of equanimity have more transformative potency, and they require significantly more concentration. The Pali Canon differentiates between worldly and renunciate varieties of equanimity. It differentiates between 36 different kinds of equanimity, but basically, there's worldly and renunciate level. So I'm giving you the streamlined version here today. The worldly version is basically what we do in the dealing with stress workshop, largely. There's behavioral, in which we don't throw a tantrum. Right, we grow this capacity by resisting the urge in the moment to push or pull. A moment arises, we have that urge, somehow we don't do it. We decide not to. So it's conscious, it's intentional, it's effortful, it's in specific situations. It's weak in that it's fairly low leverage. It's very state specific. It needs lots of repetition to stick, right? This is fake it till you make it. This is white knuckling. This is familiar, right? We get lots of advice in this realm. It's so-so. Another version is cognitive approaches, where you're adjusting our interpretation of a situation to find more peace and ease. Requires enough mindfulness to track our state over time and catch some of the underlying beliefs. Enough pliancy to adjust them. Pliancy is the opposite of attachment. When we're attached, only this will do. When we're pliant, there's a lot of, the mind can move in a lot of different directions. A typical cognitive adjustment would be to change the time scale. So if you had a tense interaction, interpersonal interaction with someone, you're probably looking at it through the lens of an hour, which is arbitrary. And if you looked at it through the lens of a century or a second, it would look really different. It would feel really different. And so this is looking through those other lenses and noticing what happens. And it's a way of kind of prompting the insight that, oh yeah, that's arbitrary. it also needs a fair amount of repetition and doesn't generalize all that well, but it's kind of, again, sort of familiar, and you can get people to try it. Throughout life, like noting the aspect of impermanence as it shows up is a way of cultivating this, right? Of like making it easier to find equanimity. You can do an equanimity meditation similar to metta. Instead of "may you be at ease, may you be happy," you might, you find an equanimity phrase that works for you. There's lots of options, but you can find some. Another version, focusing more on karmic layer. When we're doing karmic work, basically we're adding quality awareness to unprocessed residue, right? Again, who we are is just the result of phantasms of who we have been and the current condition. And who we have been, we all have loads of less processed karmic residue that didn't get digested when it happened and is still affecting us. And so we're operating under that burden. We work with precepts, we add meditation to areas of tension and stress. That helps. Gradually we clean up the residue. And even that is layer by layer, right? It's contextual. It's like context by context. We get less reactive, more self-aware. If we do enough of that, that becomes our new conditioning. Sometimes we can catch it in the moment and adjust and find that equanimity. Sometimes we see it and we can't make that shift. Again, like, celebrate that you saw it, right? You don't give yourself a hard time for not being able to make this shift. Like, it's still happening. Like, life is still happening. You're still getting new information. So really, like treasure that chance to continue learning about these karmic knots. Whether or not we can change our behavior in the moment is not the be-all end-all. It's just an aspect. And staying aware, staying interested, not making it about who I am, is important there. The primary limitation with this is that we're getting less reactive about the situation that has arisen, right? About our current situation. So we have to wait for it to arise. Meditative equanimity it happens when we clarify our mind with deeper meditation. And it doesn't have the same constraint, right? It affects us at very deep levels. So instead of, when we're not responding to an array of stimulus and the mind has really stilled, what bubbles up are more fundamental issues. I am separate, right? If we can meet that with equanimity, it affects lots of life, right? It affects lots of situations. Those are insights that are much harder to have, but much farther reaching, much more generalizable. It's not necessary that we do that, right? We can get lots of benefit from what the Pali Canon is calling worldly equanimity. But I want to include this in the conversation, in the sense of what's possible. Insight transforms us in a much more lasting way. it's a real investment to access the depth required to have life-changing insights like that. But hold out the possibility that this can happen. It does happen. People have life-changing experiences and they're hard to predict. The fact that it hasn't happened yet or hasn't happened to the degree that you like is not evidence that it won't. Okay, I think I want to hear questions now.
If you are in the room and have a question, please raise your hand, say your name into the microphone when I hand you the microphone, and please hold it close to your mouth. If you're on Zoom and have a question, you can either type your name into the chat and Tony, our co-host, will unmute you so you can ask, or you can type your question into the chat and Tony will ask it.
Amy here. Thank you for your talk. I love this topic. I have a question and I want to use an example that you sometimes use when you're doing foundational teachings, and that's like, what do you think of when you think of the smell of cut grass? And I usually have a negative association with that because I think, oh God, we've got to mow the lawn, or I mowed the lawn. And so I'm wondering if in this process, the idea is to get more comfortable about mowing the lawn, or to say what's really happening here is I'm not mowing the lawn right now. I'm just smelling cut grass. Where is the focus?
Yeah, sure. So, well, there's this many different ways it could happen, right? So I think in terms of like what we do with the mind, let's say I'm smelling cut grass. I'm just going to try to like draw that out a little bit. And let's say I'm Amy and I have a little tension response. And I notice that. So like I could then identify with it and explain why I have that, or you know, make some comment or defend against like, you know, future obligation, something like that. And that just sort of like cements that a little bit more. Equanimity there would be like noticing the ick, like that just flash of ick. And what else? All right, so one thing we can do there, to it's easy to slip off the what else. It's easy to like, what, and then go into story of like defending against future obligation. But so try to extend that enough so that the ick like is gone. And so maybe that's investigation. Like maybe you like what does that actually smell like? Like, can you just give yourself the full olfactory experience of that? It's one thing to identify it, and we need 5% of the smell to do that. But if we're trying to do more, if we're trying to really experience it, like there's more smell there. There's more like overtones, undertones, like, wow, it's just, there's a lot. There's a lot going on in sensory experience. It's so much. So relish that, you know, dive into that. Cognitive strategy might be like pausing and noticing the next thought to arise is like, I haven't mowed my lawn yet. Like, oh, maybe you see that and you move to compassion. Like, ooh, that's tough to like have that. You can offer yourself some compassion there, right? Just like kind of a softening, a gentleness. For instance, right? Like it's just, creating the space for something new to happen.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Smell the grass.
Smell the grass.
This is Jesus Song. Thank you for your talk, Dr. Neal. I guess I'm wondering a bit about the kind of has to do with this near enemy business about equanimity. If sometimes what I guess I'll call our doctrine can get in the way of it. And that's probably not a good way to phrase it, but I'm thinking in particular about one of our core concepts, which is impermanence. If something really unfortunate happens and we just say, oh well, impermanence, we can't really miss whatever that thing was that, you know, meditation hall that burned down or whatever, because it was going to be gone someday anyway. It feels to me like escapism.
Yeah, that feels like near enemy to me.
Okay.
But that's not insight into impermanence.
No, is it using that concept as a way to avoid actually dealing with the situation?
Well, yeah, I would say that the, we're intellectually clever, you know, we're pretty fast moving in terms of thought, and can find lots of ways to misuse things. So that's an example. But I would say that's not like felt sense, like that's not grounded in a like actually landing impermanence. Right? Like coming from that insight, that's not a response that I would expect.
Okay.
So in terms of like discernment with yourself, when you're like in the midst of stuff and like, oh, is this like near enemy or not? Like, does it feel like a defense? Does it feel like you're pulling yourself away from something? Or does it feel like you're like right there and fully available? And equanimity feels like you're fully available. Like you're closer than you would otherwise be.
Okay, on Zoom, there's a question from Patrick. He says, thanks for the talk. If I understand you correctly, then action and inaction being of the nature of life, one can decide to, say, go to the No Kings March because it seems to be an action of benefit to beings, generating good karma. But equanimity would involve not being fussy about the route or refusing to participate because you didn't like the language others used on signs and so on. That's the question.
So what I would say there is that, that's a complex, example because notice the difference between that and the smell of grass. Like the smell of grass is a momentary sensation. Like it arises. Oh, what do? The decision to go to a No Kings March or not, happens over weeks. Like you've been hearing about it for weeks. You've been thinking of past experiences. Like it's like that's such a big target. And so it's not a matter of like what do I do with equanimity here? It's like, what do I do with equanimity here? Like there's thousands of potential equanimity like misses and failures in that. And that's how we have to approach it.
Thank you.
Thank you for your talk. This is Setan. I was curious about you spoke about when being equanimous feels dangerous almost. And I know in my experience, there are moments when I'm trying to be with maybe a sensation of intense anxiety, for example. And it feels like, okay. Yeah, like it can get so intense that kind of what you were saying, like, oh, like there's a fear of losing my sense of self in this, or it can almost get so intense that, like, I'm thinking of like complexes almost.
Yeah, but I would say that that's not like, that's not equanimity. So, like, equanimity may still happen, but it's not there if that's what it feels like.
If the anxiety or the feeling of danger is there,
yeah,
that isn't equanimity.
Right.
Interesting. Okay. So, what would it be instead?
Like, what would that, like, are you asking what is that experience?
Sure.
Well, like, so I'm gonna like reach a little.
Okay.
So, and this may not be your situation, but I think it's a familiar situation that shows up. So I'm speaking more to the room than to Setan. Like, as we're doing karmic work, like, there's soft spots. There's things which feel like it's a really big deal, and we don't want to tread there. We don't want to go there. And so we steer around them. And there can be a lot of, and typically, like, there's a lot of justification there. Like, there's a lot of identification with those choices. So those become little behavioral patterns that get quite hard, get quite rigid. And so, like, fear is one of the responses when that's like kind of like touched on. So I think I lost your original question there. But say that's arising, say like we've touched on one of those, and we aspire to have equanimity, but we're really like frightened of it. You know, similar to the grass, I would say like start with like appreciation of like, oh, okay, like I'm really frightened. I'm like, I'm aware of the intensity of this experience right now. And there's part of us that is like trying to get away from it, trying to like isolate it somehow, and to like, what can we do to melt that? What can we do to melt that activity? It's usually felt as constriction. It's usually felt as some kind of tension. And like, can we give ourselves that like prompt to like melt that? And I don't know, that for me, that's a useful like sort of trying to elicit more equanimity. Is that useful?
Yeah, that is. And then I'm imagining there is something underneath that. Yeah, you're actually able to be in that state with.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, this is Tony. I have a question. Can you say something about complacency? I'm thinking about actual, if equanimity comes about during Zazen. I mean, for me, this is amazing. I mean, the fact that what you were saying about, you know, something comes up, I don't like this, but I can just let it go and move on. After all these years, this is a, you know, major achievement. But I'm always fighting it going in the opposite direction, just sliding into complacency. Mm-hmm. It's okay, it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter what happens in Zazen. Whatever happens is what happens. And, you know, that trap thought.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. That actually came up in Sanzen today. And, you know, like that, well, whatever happens, you know, like that's the like protectiveness.
Yeah.
That's steering around our own internal judgment of, am I doing it right? Essentially. And I think the remedy there is to be nicer to yourself, to like, oh, I caught myself. Like, that is actually pleasant. That's pleasurable. That is a delight. It doesn't have to be like, oh, punishment of like, I did it again, right? Like, I like really like delight is so important in practice. It's much, much stronger motivation than judgmentalness.
Yes. Yes. I have experienced that, but, you know, you can waste 19 of 20 minutes of Zazen doing that. I think the key word there is waste. I think what you're saying is there isn't wasting time.
I don't think you're wasting Zazen if you're appreciating that you noticed.
Okay.
That feels pretty productive to me. I'm happy if that's how I spent 19 out of 20 minutes.
Okay, well, I'm happy too then. Thank you.
I'm willing to bet that you would be.
It's been a struggle. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your talk. I'm Guy. I was wondering about a theme that I've noticed a lot, which is one factor that you know shakes my equanimity is the expectations of others and living up to them. And in some measure, you do have to live up to the expectations of others, or you can cause damage and feel regret as a result. And so you can't be dismissive of those expectations. But on the other hand, sometimes those expectations are shallow and superficial and could shake your resolve to follow the path that you see as really fit and proper. And I'm stuck figuring out, you know, how to develop the discernment between those two. So I'm wondering if you have any ideas.
Yeah. So like this is kind of like the no kings question in a way.
I mean, anything. The grass too, actually, because one of the reasons you might cut the grass is because people expect the grass to be a certain height. But actually, maybe you figure out ecologically that it's better if it's a little higher because it supports more animals.
I have figured that out.
You know, there's like a lot of different contexts that it could arise.
Yeah. No, I guess what I'm saying is we're looking for like the smallest moment, the smallest decision point. Right. And to recognize that, like, in like big questions, like, what am I doing with my life? Like, am I measuring up to my like parents' expectations for me or whatever? There's not going to be an answer. There's going to be thousands of contradictory answers over time. And that's realistic and appropriate and rich and nuanced and like actually how we want to live, because we want something that's honest. And so to like delve into that complexity and recognize that on some days it's going to be clear what you're doing, and some days you're going to be confused about it. And that's actual, and that gives you real leverage in terms of your awareness in life.
So focusing on a much more almost microscopic level.
Yeah. Question. Yeah. 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 And that's why this depends on, you know, some stability of mindfulness, that we can kind of hold a continuity of mindfulness during the day. It's not if we remember to check in like once in the morning, once at night, like it's not going to be enough to hold that, right?
Thank you.
Okay, online there's a question from Grant. He says, I feel equanimity is easier to touch for personal experiences, but how does it interact with responsibility for others' well-being? For example, looking after a child.
Can you draw that out a little more?
Hang on, slow.
Oh, sorry. You're reading it. Okay.
Okay, should be able to speak now. Maybe. No.
Okay, let me take a stab then. So if we're in a caretaker role of some sort or teaching role or whatever, like, you know, we have wishes for ourselves. We also have wishes for someone else. The wish isn't the problem, right? Like, I'm not, like, that's the error of neutrality. Like, we're not trying to be, like, neutral about raising a child. We're obviously quite invested in who they are and what their experience is, and but we're trying to, like, catch the attachment, that it be a particular way, and notice that, like, with that attachment comes suffering and inflexibility, and with that we get less information, we get less capacity, and to really, like, care about receiving as much input as we can, which means really being as open as we can.
Hi, this is Julie. Can equanimity include the experience of the feeling of really not wanting to cut the grass?
Yeah. So I think, I think that might be similar to Seton's question of, okay, what's something really aversive, like, say, is cutting the grass? Like that's the content of experience. What's our relationship to that content? So, like, and again, at this point, like, you've noticed that the grass is, like, waving, and so the thought arises, I should cut that, and then you have that aversive experience. Like, okay, what then? Like, and I think the, like, it's easy to reinforce that. Can we, like, open there, right? And have that, like, oh, I really don't want to cut the grass. I'm okay with experiencing, I really don't want to cut the grass. Like, that's possible. It's, the trick is, it's fairly likely that if we hold that, we're going to get caught by it, right? In part because I ended up with a conceptual example. And so, like thought is just pretty fast and sneaky. If you were staying with it at the level of, like, seeing the grass waving, you might have an easier time of just staying, like, returning to the sensory experience of it and finding equanimity there. But if you're dealing with it at level of, like impulse to behavior and the resistance to that, that would be harder to sustain.
But it can include, like, our attractions and aversions. Yeah. That can be. Okay.
Yeah. No.
Hello. Thank you for the talk. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there's any state in which you can have, like, a preparatory kind of experience with equanimity, or is it always a response to an experience?
Yeah. Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, it might be a little bit of a trick question because there's always an experience. Mm-hmm. Like, there's always something happening. I think like, there's something like what you're getting at is, I think, is, like, how do we set ourselves up to be able to be equanimous? And I'd really point to, like continuity of mindfulness, that like, there's a frequency to which we are, like, landing in felt experience of who I am, what it's like to be me, and that that we're, like, kind of pushing that edge of, like, how clear is it? Because we can be mindful, like, oh, this is me, in sort of like a passing trivial way, and we can be, like I said, like oh yeah, that's grass, that's cut grass, or like we can, like, be suffused with, like the like overwhelmingness of cut grass, that's really quite vivid and like show-stopping. There's quite a range of how clear we are in a moment, and to like push into that when we have a chance.
Thank you.
Yeah. Maybe last one. There's a couple of.
Hi, I'm Benny. I feel like equanimity in terms like experience, it's easier or feels a little bit easier when it's like a tense situation or
tense?
Negative, tense, like a difficult situation.
Yeah.
But what about when things are going well?
Good.
How do you still sort of maintain equanimity?
Yeah. Yeah. Like if you notice that the grass is blowing and you love cutting the grass. Nice. Yeah. Attachment and aversion dovetail. So when it's really pleasant, like we don't want it to end. Right. And so there's a protection around like, how do I extend this? How do I protect it? How do I like save it? And you know, we experience that as constriction. So it's really quite similar. We think we prefer it, but it's also like tight and limiting in its own way.
Yeah.
And it's harder, like it takes a little more resolution, I believe, to like want to be equanimous when it's pleasant. Having a little more momentum is helpful there. But yeah, it's really the same. It's really the same like movement.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I will say that this is a hard topic. I'm drenched. And like I feel like I've had more like word stumbles than I expect, and like it makes sense. Like this is something that really does come up a lot for like all kinds of practitioners, and it's really like difficult and rich area to explore. So please do.